Lebanon. Sheikh Naim Qasim warned that the resistance group's patience has limits.
Everything has a limit. Don't take what we say lightly. Be aware that this resistance is and it is committed at this time to the agreement. However, if Israel doesn't commit at all, and if the Lebanese state isn't able to bring about the necessary results or the required results politically, we would hence have no such choice to resort to other options.
Sheikh Naim Qasim urged Lebanon's government to enforce the agreement and put an end to the Israeli regime's relentless and blatant violations. He stressed that Hezbollah remains committed to the ceasefire agreement but is ready to defend Lebanon if diplomacy fails. The Hezbollah leader accused Israel of pursuing expansionist goals, citing its unrelenting strikes and illegal presence in Lebanon. He was speaking on the occasion of the International Quds Day. Sheikh Naim Qasim stressed that this is a day for confronting oppression everywhere and standing in solidarity with Palestine and all the oppressed people around the world. Israel's latest strikes have claimed the lives of over 24 civilians and left many others injured across the besieged Gaza Strip. One of the latest attacks killed 3 Palestinians and injured several others after Israeli boat targeted the vicinity of the Al Nur Mosque west of Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. 6 Palestinians, including 3 women, were killed and many others injured in northern Gaza Strip. In the southern city of Rafah, an Israeli drone strike killed a 9-year-old child and injured 5 others, mostly children. Another drone strike hit a house in Rafah, killing an 80-year-old child and injuring his mother and sister. 6 civilians were also killed when an Israeli airstrike targeted a house east of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. An Israeli airstrike on a Palestinian home in Beit Lahia, northern Gaza, caused fatalities and injuries. The death toll from the regime's genocide is now near 50,300, with over 114,000 others injured. Our Gaza correspondent Moti Abu Musabe joined us earlier to provide us with the latest updates on the Israeli attacks across the blockaded territory. Let's take a listen.
The death toll of the Palestinian people being slaughtered since dawn hours till this moment has risen to 24 Palestinian civilians after the Israeli occupation forces committed another massacre here in Deir al-Balah city by killing 3 Palestinian civilians. Those people were killed while they were taken and having their iftar meal in the western part of Deir al-Balah city. Their makeshift tent was hit deliberately by the Israeli fighter jets, and they have been brought to the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital as you know, as small pieces, revealing how brutal the attack was. And as you know, the Israeli retaliation is still maintained against various parts of Gaza Strip, and it is really intensified right now against the western part of Rafah city, whereas, as you know, the people there are still stranded in Tal al-Sultan neighborhood and the Saudi village for more than a week, and they are still exposed to the relentless Israeli bombardments, attacks, and the gunfire. Hundreds of the Palestinian families are still appealing for having, as you know, an access to the basic humanitarian essentials amid the ongoing blockade imposed by the Israeli occupation forces, while the Israeli artillery shelling also is still maintained against several parts of the northern section of Gaza, basically Beit Lahia city. In addition to that, the Israeli occupation forces on the ground detonated several essential buildings in Beit Lahia city, and we are still hearing the Israeli fighter drones are still flying at low levels in all areas of Gaza.
An amusement park that was once a place of celebration is now surrounded by displacement tents in Gaza. Our correspondent Ahmed Al-Najjar visited the site and spoke to locals. They shared their grief, saying that the Israeli regime has stolen their happiness and left them homeless during a time they should be celebrating in the warmth of their homes.
Here in Al-Mawasi area in western Khan Yunis is one of the few amusement parks across the Gaza Strip, a place that once represented joy and celebratory moments for children and their families who are welcoming Eid after the end of the holy month of Ramadan. This place that was once vibrant with children and their families, the echoing of their laughter as they are riding these games, that are now standing idle, surrounded by hundreds of tents that were constructed by the Palestinian families who were forced out of their towns and were forced into endless cycles of displacement for more than a year now. These tents are now overshadowing this scene of having these games and joy for children.
This park used to be a reminder of fun and joyful times for families. For 2 years now, the occupation has stolen our happiness, depriving us of all our special celebrations. It's Eid, a time when we should be baking cookies and decorating our homes, but instead, we are homeless. Happiness has become an impossible wish these days.
This amusement park was filled with green spaces to receive the families in such special occasions, but what really gave this park its joyful aspect is the existence of many of the games, like the Ferris wheel, the pirate ships, the roller coaster, and all our modest games. But today, as the families are welcoming the Eid, these games stand idle. There's no way to power them because the families can barely find and secure their basic humanitarian needs. And now all these games are surrounded by this miserable scenes of tents, of displacement and suffering.
As we welcome Eid, all we wish for is for this genocide to end. For a year, we have been away from our homes, sheltering in a place we never imagined we'd be. We once brought our children here to celebrate and have fun on this special day, but now we can't even get them with new clothes or offer them safety.
For the second year in a row, the Palestinians across the Gaza Strip welcome the festive Eid al-Fitr with nothing but more miseries and suffering. This place that should be filled with the laughters of children is now covered and overshadowed by the miserable scene of displacement that doesn't seem to end any soon for the families here. Ahmed al-Najjar, Al-Mawasi.
A senior Hamas official says the movement has agreed to a new Gaza ceasefire proposal offered by mediators and is awaiting the Israeli regime's response. In a televised speech, Khalil al-Hayya said Hamas has responded positively and responsibly to the new proposal. Hayya expressed hope that the occupying regime would not obstruct the proposal and thwart the mediators' efforts. Hayya, however, stressed that the resistance's weapon is a red line because it is linked to the establishment of an independent Palestinian state. He noted that the resistance would not accept any deal that would involve the expulsion and displacement of Palestinians from their land. He said the cabinet of the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu continues to stall and prevent the realization of a ceasefire agreement. Hayya said Netanyahu is trying to prolong the war on Gaza to ensure the survival of his cabinet for as long as possible. He said Netanyahu understands that the survival of his cabinet depends on the continuation of the Gaza war. Author and political analyst Eve Ongler believes that Israel cannot be trusted with any deals and the international community must pressure the regime to uphold its side of the Gaza truce.
There's no reason to trust Israel. The people, you know, Katz was pretty straightforward a few days ago now, I guess a week ago maybe, about their genocidal intent. They want to kill and they want to kill. They want to drive everyone out. And the ceasefire is obviously an impediment in doing that, and so you know, shouldn't be trusted. Now, you know, what's the alternative, though? Unfortunately, from Hamas's perspective, they've been agreeing to the previous proposal that was supposed to go to round two, and Israel's, you know, avoiding. But it's a matter of international pressure. And that's not easy to organize when you have this administration in Washington that is totally fanatical in their hostility to Palestinians. So you don't trust Israel. You have to keep putting pressure, and obviously part of, you know, from Hamas's perspective, Part of the pressure is being able to respond militarily. And then for those of us who are not in Gaza, who are, you know, international, you know, in, here in Canada, is to put pressure on my government, which just, you know, it just came out that they approved $80 million arms. They claim to have stopped arms transfers, but they just approved an $80 million contract.
Meanwhile, scuffles have broken out in Tel Aviv between Israeli forces and demonstrators who call on the regime to stop attacking Gaza and secure the release of all the captives held there. The protesters denounced the handling of the Gaza war by the cabinet of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the repeated violations of the ceasefire deal. They warned that returning to war in Gaza could sacrifice their loved ones, stressing that military pressure cannot save the captives. The protesters also slammed the regime's efforts to dismiss the head of Shin Bet and the Attorney General, who are opposed to Netanyahu. The new rally followed a surge in demonstrations throughout the week across the occupied Palestinian territories. The weekly protests revealed a rising dissent against Netanyahu's cabinet over the resumption of the onslaught on Gaza. Israeli forces have killed and injured more civilians as they press ahead with the violent raids on Palestinian towns and villages across the occupied West Bank. In one of the latest incursions, the regime's forces fatally shot a 22-year-old Palestinian man in the northern West Bank town of Tamun. The man was critically injured by Israeli forces' live fire and was later pronounced dead. His body has been taken away by the regime's forces. Israeli forces also wounded two Palestinians in another raid east of Nablus. Local sources said a child and a young man were injured by Israeli live fire during a raid on the town of Beit Furik. The new fatalities bring to nearly 940 the total number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces across the West Bank since the regime's genocidal war started in Gaza. Our Ramallah correspondent, Nika Hamed, joined us earlier to bring us up to speed on the latest Israeli crimes across the occupied West Bank. Let's see what she had to say.
The IOF is still raiding Tubas until this moment. And as we have spoken to local resources, they have informed that this raid and this series of raids upon Tamun today marks a very violent attack on the area where it is located to the south of Tubas. The Palestinian Ministry of Health has informed that a Palestinian young man, Ahmed Qasim Bani Oudeh, was shot, killed by the IOF forces, raiding IOF forces towards Tamun, and his body was detained under the pretense that he was fighting back or resisting the IOF. And of course, this leads to such action by the IOF. This actually adds up to the total detained bodies of the Palestinian martyrs, up to 625 Palestinian martyrs who have been in captivity and either in the Israeli refrigerators or in the what is known as the cemeteries of numbers. Of course, this is not the first attack on Tamun. We have seen many attacks upon this small village, but it is indeed a small village, but a great turmoil over there is going on.
A senior Yemeni official has once again reaffirmed the country's continued support for the people of Palestine until the liberation of their sanctities and occupied land. The comment was made by the chairman of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, on the occasion of Eid al-Fitr, which marks the end of the fasting month of Ramadan. He stressed that Yemen will not stop supporting the Palestinian people and their resistance. Mashat also touched on U.S. aggression against Yemen, saying Washington is attacking Yemen to support Israel's crimes against the Palestinian people. Mashat emphasized that the U.S. aggression will not deter Yemen from supporting Palestine, nor will it weaken the will of the Yemeni people. His remarks came as the United States continued its airstrikes on Yemen. According to the country's media, 9 airstrikes targeted Saada governorate, including Al-Salem and Kataf districts and the eastern part of Saada city, damaging public and private property. American warplanes also carried out several airstrikes on Yemen's capital, Sana'a. Iran's foreign minister says the U.S. attacks on Yemen shows Washington's complicity in Israel's attempts to spread insecurity and stability in the region. Abbas Araghchi was speaking in a meeting with UN Special Envoy to Yemen, Hans Grundberg, in Tehran. The top Iranian diplomat condemned the repeated U.S. attacks on Yemen, which has led to the deaths of civilians and the destruction of the country's infrastructure. Araghchi also criticized the United Nations Security Council's inaction regarding the blatant violations of international law by Israel and the U.S. For his part, the U.S. Special Envoy thanked Iran for his continued support of the U.N.'s efforts towards peace in Yemen. Grundberg reiterated that achieving stability and peace in Yemen is an urgent necessity. With that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for listening. Take care and bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
سبحان الله والحمد لله لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر لا إله إلا الله.
Let's listen to the famous reciters of the Holy Quran in the month of Allah.
سبحان الله
Brother Muhammad Reza Birya, only in IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of the Month of Allah. We're going to be talking about famous reciters of the Quran and the world of Islam. Today, we'll be talking about Brother Muhammad Javad Hosseini, Sayyid Muhammad Javad Hosseini. He is a very famous reciter right now, not only in Iran, but in the whole world. And you can probably watch his videos on YouTube. If you search Muhammad Javad Hosseini, you'll notice that there are a lot of videos of him on the internet and on YouTube. This reciter was born in 1983 in a city close to Mashhad, where the shrine of Imam Ridha is located. He started learning Quran at the age of 11, and his teacher was his brother, Mustafa Hosseini. He started learning the Quran at an early age when he was 11 years old, and his teacher was his brother, Sayyid Hassan Hosseini. Later, in order to learn the other rules of recitation such as tajweed, maqamat, and waqf wal-ibtida, he became the student of great masters of Quran such as Mustafa Javidi and Mr. Sadat Fatemi. Brother Sayyid Muhammad Jawad Hosseini participated in the Quran competition held in Iran in the year 2009, and he placed first. He won the competition. And this was the very first time that he participated in an international competition. This recitation that we're about to listen to is a recitation which was performed in Madinatul Sadr of Baghdad, which is a district in the city of Baghdad in Iraq. And it's interesting that in this recitation, one of the people in the audience asked Brother Muhammad Jawad Hosseini to recite the verses 89 to 90 of Surah Al-Anbiya in Maqam Kurd. He smiled, and then he used Maqam Kurd in this recitation that we're about to listen to. And it's very interesting that someone from the audience requests the reciter to use such and such maqam. And we see this in the recitation performed by Brother Muhammad Jawad Hosseini. He uses maqam kurd in the recitation that we're about to listen to right now, which is Suratul Anbiya, verses 89 to 90 by Sayyid Muhammad Jawad Hosseini. Let's enjoy this recitation.
وَزَكَّرِيَّا and mention Zechariah when he called to his Lord, "My Lord, do not leave me alone with no heir, while you are the best of inheritors." So we responded to him, and we gave to him John, and amended for him his wife. Indeed, they used to hasten to good deeds and supplicate us in hope and fear, and they were to us humbly submissive.
We're not in the front lines out there. We're not being targeted. What we can do is create awareness.
If you look at the human race, there's one thing that we all unanimously agree, that in order to succeed in this world, one has to struggle.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Foresight, and I'm your host, Mehdi. Please stay with us. يا إله كل شيء ومليك يا رب كل شيء وسانع يا خالق كل شيء. Today's tip: how much pressure should we put on ourselves while we conduct our ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah? So, dear listeners, we are humbly at your service here on Foresight, talking about something which is quite important, and that is how much pressure should we put on ourselves when it comes to our ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah. Now, this is something that most probably we have asked ourselves, or we have asked somebody else about, is how much pressure should we put on ourselves when it comes to conducting our ubudiyya, doing our ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to the Almighty Allah. Now, of course, you know, first and foremost, we need to realize that we should put pressure on ourselves in order to conduct the various forms of ubudiyya, worship and servitude and obedience to Allah. So I think we should start with the things that are wajib, the things that are obligatory, and the things that are haram, the things that are prohibited. Now, when it comes to the wajib things, the things that are obligatory, and when it comes to the haram things, the things that are prohibited, we should put the utmost pressure on ourselves to do the wajib things and to not do the haram things, right? So these are two aspects in which we do need to put pressure on ourselves, right? Now, when it comes to the recommended things, the things that are mustahab, they are recommended, or the things that are makruh, it is better to not do those things, they are makruh. In these fields, we don't need to put as much pressure, at least in the initial stages of spiritual wayfaring. And of course, the things that are mubah, that they are neutral, you know, there is a neither for or against, well, you know, that is even a, you know, last part of where we should be putting our pressure on. So we should put pressure on ourselves when it comes to the, for example, five daily prayers. Now, of course, this also depends. Everything needs to be in balance. So, for example, if for whatever reason, God forbid, we're not doing any of the five daily prayers, well, we probably should not put pressure on ourselves that from tomorrow, we're going to read all five with the utmost pressure. Everybody needs to gauge themselves and be sincere with themselves as well. So sometimes we have a tendency to fool ourselves and say, you know, I can only do one prayer a day for the next 6 months until I get to the second prayer. Now, maybe there's somebody out there like that, but I highly doubt it. Most of us should not fool ourselves. We should be sincere, you know, that, okay, tomorrow I will at least pray one prayer. And the next day I will pray, you know, two prayers. And the next day I will pray three prayers. Or tomorrow I will do four. Or tomorrow. And in this manner, we need to put pressure on ourselves so that we start doing at least the wajib prayers. When it comes to fasting, you know, if for some reason we haven't fasted in our lives, well, this holy month of Ramadan, we are going to, the first week, we're going to fast, right? And gauge yourself. The point of what I'm trying to make is sometimes if we put too much pressure on ourselves, we aren't able to do anything. And this itself is one of the tricks of Satan, is to somehow, you know, have us put so much pressure on ourselves. And even if it isn't Satan, even if we have a positive, you know, outlook, or we have a good intention, we put a lot of pressure on ourselves. And what that does is that ends up breaking us. IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Asad Jafari.
We're not in the front lines out there. We're not being targeted. What we can do is create awareness. But that awareness has to come within first. And part of that process is to adopt the seerah of the Ahlul Bayt. One seerah of the Ahlul Bayt that we have to understand in this era of the ghibat of the Imam is the ability to turn hardship into worship. It's not going to get any easier. Our fifth Imam says that if the individuals knew the events that would lead towards the zuhur of my grandson, they wouldn't want to be alive during that time. Amir al-Mu'mineen was hit with a poisonous sword on the morning of the 19th of Ramadan. He said one phrase. Stubira bil Ka'aba is a very famous statement, he says. I would say, Amir al-Mu'mineen, you are the one that destroyed 70 kuffar in Badr. You were the one that ripped the door of Khaybar. You were the one that killed Amr ibn Abdaud. You were the one that the Prophet said, you kullu iman in Jangi Khandak. You were 33 years old in Ghadir. But nowhere do we hear the announcement of the success of Amir al-Mu'mineen. When he was hit with the sword, he announced his success. The hardship of that moment turned into the worship of Amir al-Mu'mineen. You asked the sister Imam Hussein, Bibi Zainab, salamullah alayha, that how did you find the day of Ashura? Imam Hussein's mission of Karbala ended on Asr Ashur, physically at least. She took that and she continued it all the way back to Medina. It's not easy to take 200 plus kids on that journey. It's not easy to take Imamah on your back across that journey, but she did that. And she witnessed everything from the shahadat of her own sons, her own nephews, her own brother, everything. And when she was asked, she simply said, what? Ma ra'aytuhu illa jamila. I saw nothing on that day but beauty. Can you imagine for a moment? Watch your brother who has been with you since day number one, 200 plus arrows in his body. And you're witnessing that with your own eyes. And you equate that to beauty? Ma ra'aytuhu illa jamila. Hardship into worship.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about how much pressure to put on ourselves when it comes to our ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah. So we said that, you know, we have to be careful because sometimes, yes, we have this really good energy and we have this very positive outlook and this good niyyah, this good intention, you know, and we end up putting so much pressure on ourselves and we end up burdening ourselves so much that we cannot bear that pressure, sometimes because we're young, sometimes because we're inexperienced, or sometimes because, you know, we don't know what exactly is going on. And so many of these spiritual wayfaring masters, they have told us that in whatever stage of this spiritual wayfaring that one is, this ubudiyya that an individual is in, this worship, this servitude, and this obedience to the Almighty Allah, is to always be aware of what condition their soul is in and to try to be kind and have a caring outlook to one's soul and avoid burdening it more than it can bear. Because if we put too much pressure, then it'll end up breaking. But that does not mean that we shouldn't put any pressure. Now, when it comes to the haram things and the prohibited things, we can't just be like, okay, I'm not going to put any pressure. I'm going to go ahead and, God forbid, I'm just going to drink, you know, one bottle of alcohol. No, we, in that situation, we have to put a lot of pressure on ourselves and we need to stop, you know, and realize that these things are haram. But in other things, you know, for example, things that are not haram, we don't necessarily have to put too much pressure. So we have to, at the end of the day, I think, be sincere with ourselves, be sincere with the Almighty Allah. Our intention must be sincere. And we have to remember that these things are processes. They happen over a long period of time, you know. And yes, you know, we can't just, you know, be kind of lazy for the fajr, the morning pre-dawn prayers, right? We can't just be like, well, I'm tired. I'm not going to put pressure on myself, you know, put the alarm on snooze. That's not being sincere with ourselves, and it's not being sincere with the Almighty Allah. And if we are sincere with ourselves, especially when we realize that this is something which will build our hereafter, it will build our eternal home. And it is something that is required from us by the Almighty Allah for our benefit. Then we will start to put pressure on ourselves and we will try and we will struggle. You know, one of the very general meanings of jihad is struggle, is to fight, is to work hard, is to be tireless in our efforts and struggle, you know, in order to walk this path of the Almighty Allah and this path of ubudiyya, the worship, the servitude, and the obedience to Allah.
Muhammad, ya Rasulullah, يا حبيب الله يا خليل الله محمد.
Now we invite you to listen to Brother Hassanain Rajabali.
If you look at the human race, there is one thing that we all unanimously agree, that in order to succeed in this world, one has to struggle. And we actually honor people when they struggle, because a lazy person, a person who takes shortcuts, is not a very progressive individual. So we understand that as a reality in our existence. Having said that, when God asks us to sacrifice, that's in line with this reality. And therefore, we find that when a person is willing to sacrifice, it's a very positive situation. It's not negative. In fact, the term love, which we all like to use very much, when we say we love you, we love the world, it's a loving world. The word love is a very positive term generally, but we find love is meaningless if the word and the reality of sacrifice is not in line with it, juxtaposition with it. So one can never say that I love you without being willing to sacrifice. So sacrifice and love are synonymous terms that cannot be replaced. So having said that, when God asks us to sacrifice, it's not to cause harm and struggle upon us, unnecessary struggle, but it is to prove the point of love, and that position of love has a direct position with one's ability to sacrifice, which is why God is demanding sacrifices from us.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Foresight. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website at iranradio.ir. Log on to our website at iranradio.ir.
In the limelight.
Donald Trump, who took credit for the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas shortly before taking office, has made it clear that he would support Netanyahu if he chose to resume the war. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, the world woke up recently to news of massive Israeli regime strikes that killed hundreds of Palestinians, including many women and children, across the Gaza Strip. A familiar horror show that had paused briefly when the Zionist regime agreed to a ceasefire in January. The aerial blitzkrieg targeted densely populated areas, makeshift shelters, and residential buildings. Palestinian authorities reported that over 400 people have been killed, mostly women and children, and senior Hamas officials, with hundreds more injured. Hospitals and civil defense teams in Gaza have been overwhelmed by the wounded. The renewed offensive comes just 16 days after the first phase of a ceasefire agreement ended. And three-phase deal was intended to bring a definitive end to the war. A full Israeli withdrawal from Gaza and the release of all remaining Israeli captives held by the resistance movement Hamas since October 7. It marks the most significant escalation since the fragile ceasefire took effect on January 19. Condemnations poured in from around the world as images of Palestinian civilian bodies wrapped in white shrouds, soaked in blood, circulated on social media and news outlets. The United Nations released a statement saying Secretary General Antonio Guterres was shocked by Israeli regime airstrikes in Gaza, which resulted in a significant number of civilian deaths. The UN chief, along with many world leaders, including some of Israel's allies, strongly appealed for the ceasefire to be respected. But the question is, why did Israeli regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu order the resumption of no-holds-barred war on Gaza? To understand the rationale behind this decision, it is important to examine the interplay of domestic pressures, Netanyahu's own political survival, and a seeming policy shift by the United States under President Donald Trump. Zionist regime officials claim the new offensive aims to target Hamas leadership, which has re-emerged to regain control of Gaza. They argue that the renewed attacks will help secure the release of 59 captives still being held in Gaza. However, this is hard to believe, as Hamas had been honoring its commitments under the ceasefire deal, releasing Israeli captives in batches as agreed. It was the Zionist regime that repeatedly violated the deal during its first phase by launching sporadic attacks on Gaza and refusing to move to the second phase with backing from the United States regime. The second phase would have included a permanent end to the war and a full withdrawal of occupying forces. The Zionist regime has proposed extending the first phase of the ceasefire by up to 60 days to allow for the release of more captives. Knowing this could strip it of leverage in future negotiations to end the war, Hamas rejected the proposal, calling instead for the second phase of the ceasefire to proceed as previously agreed. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime attempted to impose new terms in the talks, demanding that Hamas continue releasing Israeli captives in exchange for Palestinian prisoners, but without committing to ending the war or withdrawing its forces. Families of the captives and those already released believe that this approach will only endanger the lives of those still held in Gaza. They have been vocal in their criticism of Netanyahu, accusing him of abandoning their loved ones in favor of military escalation. An advocacy group representing the families accused the Netanyahu regime of abandoning the remaining captives in Gaza. "We are shocked, angry, and scared about the deliberate disruption of the process to return our loved ones," the group said in a statement. While polls show that most Israelis support a ceasefire to bring back the captives, there is a vocal faction of settlers and hardline cabinet members who favor continuing the war until Hamas is defeated. This divide has fueled political tensions within the regime, with many, including some of Netanyahu's allies, framing a ceasefire as unpatriotic and a sign of weakness. This political faction and their supporters advocate for the complete removal of Palestinians from Gaza, an idea that has gained traction since President Trump floated his contentious plan for the territory, which also includes Israel reclaiming control of settlements it evacuated in 2005. Netanyahu relies on this faction to maintain his coalition and prevent its collapse. They believe that brute military force against Palestinians is key to Israel's own survival. By resuming the aerial aggression, Netanyahu sought to reinforce his image as a leader unwilling to compromise with Hamas. However, this gamble could backfire and even cost him his job as prime minister, something that he holds every dear. Ultimately, for Netanyahu, the decision boils down to political survival. The prime minister faces immense pressure from his far-right coalition partners to resume the war. Some hawkish ministers had resigned or threatened to resign in protest of the January ceasefire, jeopardizing Netanyahu's coalition and his rule. The Otzma Yehudit party, led by Itamar Ben-Gvir, announced its return to the cabinet following the resumption of hostilities recently. This move provides Netanyahu with crucial votes as he works to pass a budget bill, a legal requirement to prevent his coalition from collapsing. The return of Ben-Gvir's party, which holds 6 seats in the Knesset, serves as a lifeline for Netanyahu as the deadline to approve the budget approaches. On a more practical level, it could be argued that Netanyahu used the ceasefire as a tactical retreat to replenish Israel's arsenal, which is primarily made up of U.S.-supplied weapons and ammunition. The Zionist regime military, which had been stretched thin by over 15 months of relentless bombing in Gaza, now possesses capabilities it lacked 6 weeks ago. Morale among Israeli regime troops had also reached an all-time low, with many defying orders to return to combat. Since then, warplanes and other military equipment have been repaired, and troops have had time to rest. It is likely that Netanyahu never truly intended to accept a ceasefire, but felt compelled to do so. He may have had no genuine desire to end hostilities, but was left with little choice. However, this could prove to be a miscalculation on the part of Netanyahu and his allies. Just as Israel used the pause to replenish its stocks, so did Hamas. Hamas and other Palestinian resistance groups mounted fierce resistance during the war. The Zionist regime commanders were often shocked by how quickly Hamas and other factions regrouped and re-emerged in areas of Gaza where the Zionist regime had declared them defeated. In response to the renewed Israeli regime aggression, Hamas made it clear that Israel would not achieve militarily what it failed to accomplish through negotiations. The Zionist regime has sought to dismantle Hamas through both approaches, but neither has succeeded. Netanyahu's decision to resume the war also coincides with his ongoing corruption trials and widespread protest against his policies. If convicted, Netanyahu could face prison. On the same day that Israel launched its new strikes on Gaza, a court granted his request to skip a hearing due to the renewal of the war. He could certainly use a distraction on the domestic front. However, this strategy is not without risks. A prolonged military offensive could deepen divisions within Israeli society, particularly if more captives are killed in indiscriminate bombings in Gaza. Netanyahu nonetheless appears willing to take that risk. For him, the war with Hamas is not merely a domestic issue but a critical component of Israel's regional strategy. By adopting a hardline stance, he may be aiming to send a message to the broader axis of resistance. The Trump administration's unwavering support for the Zionist regime also seems to have been a factor. It has emboldened Netanyahu to pursue a more aggressive strategy in the region, with potentially long-term implications for regional stability. Alongside the strikes on Gaza, the Zionist regime military has been conducting regular strikes on southern Lebanon since reaching a ceasefire deal with Hezbollah to end what was the longest and deadliest war between the two sides.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Hezbollah leader slams Israel's violation of the ceasefire deal with Lebanon, warning that the movement is ready to defend the country if diplomacy fails. Hamas says it has agreed to a new Gaza ceasefire proposal, adding that Netanyahu is stalling the truce efforts to ensure the survival of his cabinet. And Israeli forces clash with anti-Netanyahu protesters, demanding the regime stop the war on Gaza and secure the release of all the captives held there. Thank you for joining us. The Secretary General of the Hezbollah Resistance Movement